So let's have a look at what deadlocks are all about. So what can happen? A deadlock is a situation where the two processes that are, well, in this case, the definition is with two processes, but you can extend that to arbitrary processes. Well, if the processes are waiting for respective others to finish, and since both of them are, in this case, waiting for each other, neither of them will be able to terminate waiting. So this is, in this case, defined with just two processes and some kind of direct relation between them, with one having exactly the resource that the other needs and both want to access them in some way. But of course, this is not the only situation. You can imagine more complicated situations where you have kind of chains of resources, which if you access in an in a way that is not good, then you will wait in a kind of cycle for one of the relevant resources to be released by some other. But since we are waiting in a kind of cycle, thus this will never happen. So this can be extended to larger systems where we would just focus on the cyclic dependency between one and the other. We have an example here. So we're switching now to some more abstract thing like Java has. So here we can imagine a situation like this where we have a class which uses its monitor with the var method, and it's using its monitor via the synchronized keyword. So that was the Java construct, how to obtain a monitor. And inside we have, in some condition or something, another call to another object's bar, and this might be some class which is also of type foo. And now if we have a setting like the one below, where we have two different instances of our class foo, with foo A and foo B, and we set the respective other ones to, well, for A we set B, and for B we set A. And if we access them, the bar method in parallel, well, we abbreviate the parallelism here with this symbol, but you have to do a little bit more in Java to get them to run in parallel. However, you get the meaning, I think, what we mean here. So in principle, what should then be executed in parallel is this bar method from either A and B. And if we do so, we will get a situation where we will have class object A executing the bar method, which will at first open the monitor for the object created via this first foo instantiation. And you can imagine a situation where we will have in parallel the B, the other thread, executing B's bar, which will create the other monitor, which is associated with the second instance of our foo class. And both of them will, after they have obtained their monitor, will try to call the other's respective bar, this, and since both of them are different threads and have their own monitors already entered, they will block in this situation. So that's in principle how you can always have a simple example of a deadlock with a situation like that or something similar. Okay, so you have same thing here for at home, describing the things that we have talked about right now here. So the question is now, that's something that we don't want to have clearly, and how can we achieve it that we won't end up in such a deadlock situation? And well, for deadlocks there have been several ideas how to counter them. First of all, the idea is for deadlock to happen, we need several properties to hold, and these are the properties that we see here. And the idea for getting rid of deadlocks would be to get rid of one of the necessary conditions for such a deadlock. So let's have a short look on how the respective conditions look like. So we have, first of all, the first property is that we have mutual exclusion involved in some way. So the processes require exclusive access to something. That is the first property to hold. Then the next thing is that if a process holds a resource, it is able to wait to obtain even more resources while still holding the old resource. So wait for is one of the other conditions. Then there's no preemption, which means that there's no instance that can somehow interfere with the process waiting and claiming some resource. For example, you could imagine a virtual machine or a runtime system or a compiler to interfere with the waiting processes and to take away, for example, some of the resources that one of the processes holds. Then there's this the last property, which is the one which is kind of application driven. We have a deadlock if there is this situation of a circular wait. So when all the processes wait that are waiting for some resource, form a circle all together in their dependencies to each other. So these are the four classic conditions for deadlocks. So what do we do if we encounter a deadlock? Well, one of the solutions that I'm pretty sure that we all have at some place already seen in practice is, well, we could just ignore the situation that we could get a deadlock. That is one of the kind of laissez-faire strategies where we say, well, it's quite difficult to get rid of deadlocks, and deadlock-free system is really, really hard to implement. So in case that we try to minimize the occurrences of the number of occurrences of such deadlocks, well, we just don't care. So for non-critical desktop systems, that is one of the strategies that is actually happening in practice. That's fine as long as there's nothing critical associated with such a deadlock. And if they are really rare, well, the people that will complain are such a little group that, well, they can be just ignored or somehow dampened, like bribed or something. Well, that's actually a strategy that is quite common even in other situations. For example, there's there have been some insights into a major car manufacturer, for example, where you have to, when you provide something like a car, you might want to have, make sure that nobody is harmed and your car actually works like it is, so that it is secure and that there's nothing happening which could damage you or the car itself. And car manufacturers, for example, do a lot of testing to prevent some damage to happen. And actually, they have a fraction of their budget when developing a new car and a new component for a car, which they reserve exclusively for situations where their tests were not exhaustive enough, so that when actual unforeseen situations arise, when, for example, your handbrake loosens and your car then crashes into the one that's standing at the bottom of the hill where you have parked, well, that is, for example, one of these situations where you would just ignore that you're not exhaustively testing and just pay the sum of the what the damage actually makes. So, yeah, ignorance is one of the common strategies, but that's probably not the way that we want to treat our deadlocks. When we, we're more of an academic sort. We want to create solutions for that. So, another idea would be to try to detect such situations. So, deadlocks should be detected with, for example, something like an operating system or a virtual machine monitor or something. And if we are able to detect that there will be something like a deadlock, or that there's actually a deadlock already happened, we can imagine ways to repair that there's a deadlock in some way. So we can try to, for example, preempt somehow or try to resolve the deadlock in some way. Another way would be the prevention of deadlocks. So, for example, we would like to try to design our programs in a way that the deadlock cannot happen, or we would like to create a language where we cannot actually translate our program in the case that that there are still deadlocks possible in our program. So that would be another strategy. And the next thing would be to kind of avoid the deadlocks. So we could at some point try to make our program more annotated, for example. We could introduce annotations where we tell the compiler or the runtime system about the set of resources that we are planning to use within some fraction of code, so that we can try to schedule them in a way that they won't interfere with each other. Or we could come up with... That's not nice. we should try to... We could try to also infer the resources that are used within our code and create summaries for procedures of what are the needed resources in order to avoid the situations where we can create deadlocks. So that's also kind of a kind of prevention idea. Okay, so the only safe way for getting rid of deadlocks in our sense is that that we want to prevent them from actually happening. So one idea would be not to use these locking instructions at all. So one thing that we already had for that was these lock-free instructions. And this is kind of a a branch in research and development to come up with a lot of different log-free algorithms for well-known data structures in order to give you the tools for implementing log-free algorithms. That is one of the idea. But if you have algorithms that explicitly require locking and you just can't think of a way how to implement them without locking, you're probably still looking for some solution in that way. So the idea would here to be to kind of try to design your program with the use of locking instructions in a way that they cannot deadlock. So the key property that we want to tackle when we want to develop our program in a way that it can definitely not deadlock would be to get rid of one of the properties in that are responsible for deadlocks, and the one that we already highlighted that we have under control as programmers is the one where we require for circular dependencies in our waiting for locks. So the idea would be to get rid of these cycles. And yeah, we have already met the cycles somewhere past in our lectures and have seen that cycles and partial orderings are things that are kind of fighting against each other. So if we can organize the dependencies between our locks in a partial order, we will we can guarantee that there will never be a circular dependency because, well, it's a partial order. This is something which is mutually exclusive. So in order to get to a partial order, we should probably have a more closer look at what are the situations that we are interested in. So for that, we first look at lock sets. What is a lock set? It's a set which we, in this case, abbreviate with L. It's a set which we associate with a certain program point P, and we assume the lock set to be the set of the locks that may have been already acquired up till the point, the program point P. So nothing too difficult here. We just include all the currently held locks in this set. This is this is the lock set. Then we also need a transitive closure. Well, that's once again defined here in a formal way, but if you remember this want things, then you still remember transitive closure. So yeah. We have already talked about that. So the main thing is that we assume for a relation that the transitive closure of that relation is if we have one, the relation between the partners x1 and x2, and also relations between also the same relation between partners x2 and x3, then we will also assume x1 and x3 to be in relation. So that's the transitive closure as a kind of repetition. And yeah, so the goal now, why we need this lock set and the transitive closure, is the lock order. So the log order is an order which we establish between different logs in certain situations, especially when we encounter in a program instructions like wait or monitor enter. In case that we encounter such an instruction, we will look at the associated log set at before we execute that that instruction, which we get via this lambda that we have defined before, remember here, and we then establish the log order between all the logs that that are kept in the log set at that point. So these are all the logs that have been acquired up till that specific program point, and say that we set them in relation to the new log. This is the one that we get from the instruction itself. So that's this this one. With that, we ensure that the newer logs are in our ordering, dominating all the ones that we have already so far acquired. And we do that by gathering up all these domination information in the log set order, which is a global order that we try to establish. And we make it strict in the sense that we will see it as the transitive closure of all of these situations. Well, I think the transitive closure is already achieved by at least locally, in because we introduce this log order between all, the else that we take from the log set. However, this is just a local situation. We still have to perform the transitive closure as the log order is a global property, and at some other location we might have found other dominance relations between the logs. Because because of this kind of distributed sources for this for new contributions to the log order, we need to still perform the transitive closure of all these logs. So we end up with a global order between all the between all the logs that are occurring in our program that way. So, if we want to, yes?
Do this order depend from program point P?
The log sets, from, the log sets themselves are dependent on the program point.
And the order?
No. And we want to we want to take these dependencies between the local log sets and newly acquired logs as kind of the source for establishing a global order between all the logs. That's why we don't want the log order to be dependent on the program point directly, so we want to have a global one.
So we should write some pointer here for P.
Some what? Yeah, we should Well, yes, that's not as formal as it could be. Yeah, we would have to check this and this part here for all program points, so to say. And if we do so, we will end up with a completed globally valid order between the locks.
So we should hold for every B.
Yeah. That would be the idea. Okay. So now that we have this this criterion of a lock order, we can now check whether we have to fear situations of deadlocks in our program. And with that, we come to the property freedom of deadlock here. If there exists no particular lock from the lock set for which we depend in some way on in which the lock depends in some way on it on itself, then there's no way to construct a cycle in there. If we only have situations where we relate our lock sets by obtaining new locks, and we never generate via the transitive closure a situation where we can relate the lock to itself. Only then we can say, we can definitely say that the program is free of deadlocks. That's just saying that there's no circle in the dependencies which are induced by the order in which we obtain deadlocks. I think that needs a little bit of time to sink in.
Does this hold because of the transitive closure of those orders?
Sorry, what is with the transitive closure?
Less.
Yeah, it's a less with
is
curly.
Of
that is the transitive closure of the order that we get from the lock sets of a program point and a newly acquired lock.
So this closure helps us to exclude
the
cycles. Does it?
This compresses the cycles into the. Yeah, if you have a cycle in the closure, then we will be able to construct that situation.
In present day explanation, there is no mention of the release of the lock. So I'm not sure at that point you would do that. Okay, you have transitive closure, so you have entire program state. You're assuming none of these deadlocks gets released at any point? Or how does that figure in?
That is hidden in. That are in the acquired state at program P. So the release would remove certain locks from the acquired list.
So the program point is where you start acquiring some deadlocks until all the deadlocks you have acquired are released again.
Until all the locks that we have acquired.
The ending point of that same program point is where you have no more deadlocks.
No more locks.
No more locks.
We should have if our program is written correctly.
And where do we ever get out of that cycle? Because at that point you're saying I'm acquiring some locks and I'm never releasing them. Then any other flow country?
I have not really specified in here, because it's just an overview, how these things actually evolve throughout the program. So these sets will diminish, or should be defined in a way that they diminish as soon as we pass a release or a releasing instruction.
Well, execute two processes without just waiting until one process is completely done with all its logs.
Well, you would have to come up with a system where we start at some point like this with an empty set, and then you have instructions at the at these transitions and program points over here. And you would then have to follow the program through each of these instructions and just keep keep attention to how these acquired log sets evolve. So if we have a wait on L1, we will include L1 in there. Then we will do some other instruction. Then we will come to a point where we have wait on L2. We will have the lock set L1 and L2. And then there will be a lot of other transitions. At some point, we will come to the, what should we do? A notify or signal. Signal, I think, is the one here with just these kind of things. I should do signal on L2, and with that we would have to reduce the set once again. And before it would have been L1 and L2. So we would have to set up a whole system of set modifying effects for these transition systems. Here, for this transition system, which keeps book of all the acquired logs for each of the program points, and this would mean that for weight A, you would add A to the log set. This would be kind of the effect of a weight, and for signal, you would have to translate it with kind of something like remove A from L, like that. If you define your semantics of your system like that, you end up with the situation that we have here, where we get a lambda for all the program points, which gives us the set of, at the moment, currently acquired locks.
In the schema you just draw, didn't you just make the second lock completely useless? Since you're saying that partially ordered and L2 should always be acquired after L1, and L1 is acquired before L2, which it should be, but it's released after L2, L2 is never going to be
Well, you could directly try to acquire L2. This is this does not violate the partial order if you just acquire L2. It's just that you're forbidden to acquire L2 before L1. So this partial order lives from the fact that it's a partial order, that you can find ways around a completely sequential thing. Anyway, this is already quite deep into semantics of programs, and that's already describing kind of an abstract interpretation of the concrete semantics of such a a locking program. So yeah, one can imagine that this is just a kind of a summary that we that I give you here. In the background, there's a whole machinery of definitions working, which I wanted to spare you just in these slides, but you have to do more than just these things here. These are just the central theorems, so to say, for all that. So, of course, there's things missing, like the for all in this case, and yeah, the thing that we're doing here is that we are establishing these per program point valid lock sets, and then we take these then we select kind of all the program points where we have such wait instructions and the according lock sets. And from that, we try to construct as a global invariant the order ring between the newly acquired locks and the ones that are already acquired there. And that contributes to the global invariant that we keep for all the program run, for all the program runs. So that is the construct in behind the whole thing. Of course, this is something which is quite intensive in the sense that this is something that that covers the whole program, and it covers all the runs of the program, and makes and would make it necessary to compute quite a lot of these sets and collect all the relevant situations here, which might vary quite a lot because, well, I've made it quite simple here with just one linear sequence of instructions over here, but of course there are situations where we have, for example, cycles in there or even procedure calls, which makes the situations that arise at a certain weight quite there's a lot of these situations where we have different different lock sets for a program point, and that is something that we need to well in practice that's what's happening in a concrete system, but for our purposes where we want to come to a deadlock-free system, we need to introduce some kind of abstraction in order to cope with the multitude of concrete program states that we need to look at for that. Anyway, that's already quite deep into program analysis and all the related problems. Well, the thing is that what we are after is this situation that we want to look at the induced global dependencies of the locks, and if we have situations where we can construct a dependency of a lock on itself, then we will know for sure that that this. Or we will know that there is a deadlock in a concrete system. I have, Of course, that is a kind of a simplified property, and this is only valid if we look at ordinary semaphores. If we also have monitors, then it's not so easy anymore. For monitors, it is valid to be depending on itself. So we have, if you have a system with semaphores and monitors, then we have to differentiate between the these two kinds of locks. And if we want to guarantee freedom of deadlocks for monitors, for systems with monitors and semaphores, then we will have to check for this for that a lock is not depending on itself in this relation only within the semaphores, which we have assembled in a special semaphore list. And in case that we are looking at a monitor, we will allow for the monitor to be depending on the on itself. It's a little bit cryptic here with something being dependent on A and A being dependent on the same thing, then both have to be the same. But in essence, what is said here is that for monitors we allow that there's circles in our dependencies. Yeah. Okay. So far, this would be the ideal situation if we could actually really capture all the different situations where we obtain a certain lock, and if we can differentiate between all of them, and if we can construct the precise the precise relation between all our locks, then we could just check whether there is a cycle in our dependencies, and if there's none, we would say, well, there's no deadlock, and if there is a cycle, we would say, well, there is a deadlock. See here, that's the one. However, that is only if we really differentiate between all instances of a lock that can really happen in practice or during runtime of our program. However, that's something that I have already shown you over here. If we go away from the simple examples where we just have our sequences and introduce these loops like this one, or even introduce something like if this is our method F, and if we do a recursive call over here, then we will create recursion, which leads to an explosion of these states, and we cannot cope with keeping book of all the different all different sets of lock instances that can happen at runtime when we look at our program and try to plan it in a way that it is deadlock-free. So a common technique to circumvent this explosion of states would be to introduce summaries for locks. So we would not look at the concrete multitude of all the different lock sets that can arrive at a certain instruction that acquires a new lock, but instead we would try to summarize somehow, to abstract from the concrete sets by just looking at an over approximation of a lock set of all the locks that may be held at a certain point. That is the clue here. We would drop the property that we keep exact book of the locks, but we would try to always keep an over approximation, and we call that the set of maybe held locks. That would be the term here. That would summarize everything that could happen, which means that would summarize all the runs that reach a certain point. So with these summarized sets of monitors and locks, we can then, if we find these summarized such a cycle within the summarized sets of logs, what still is valid is if we say if there's no such cycle in our system, even with the over-approximated set of held logs, then we can still say that our program is deadlock-free. However, if we have found a circle in there, we are not quite sure whether that is a circle that is caused by our over-approximation, or it is, or whether it is caused by a real deadlock in there. However, it's still an algorithm that gives us at least half of the time an answer which we can use, which is in this case the freedom. If the, if our approach here says that there is no no circle in there, we can be sure that there's also no deadlock in there. Also, there's a little bit of problem if we still want to differentiate between monitors and pure semaphores. Well, it's not directly, but it's in there. Then we run into a problem because for monitors, there's we then would have to track whether the monitors are, yeah, if we have a if a summary of all these monitors, then we cannot differentiate anymore between the fact that the monitor is depending on itself, because that would be a valid situation and we would not count that as a deadlock. But if we summarize between several monitors, several different monitors, we cannot say anymore whether we have deadlock freedom or not in this case. So, by looking in an abstract way on our programs, we have to drop the different treatments of monitors and deadlocks, at least for the points where we do over-approximations on the monitors. So, in practice, what that all boils down to is that in order to come up with deadlock-free systems, what we can do is that we have to identify all the points where we want to acquire a lock, and we have to sort them in an ascending order according to our lock sets. That is this global invariant that we have to establish between all the locks. And then we have to, in the end, check that there's no cycle in our ordering. Well, that's it. Then there's also some parts for summary of monitor locks, which I won't go too much into detail. These we can, for a few summarized monitors, not say whether there's deadlock or not. But if they're just singletons, which just abstract one single monitor, then we still can. But yeah, that's too much into the detail. The general thing would be to try to establish an ascending order on these. So, what can we do in an algorithm when we find out that there is a cycle in our log order? Well, there is, of course, the possibility that the cycle is just due to the fact that we had to over-approximize. So the log sets are just an approximation. There might not be a concrete cycle, but we would have to try to check that more intensively, not just with that simple method. So, yeah, we'd have to look at that. But maybe they're just they're due to the overapproximation. If we're not sure, then we could try to change the way that we acquire the locks, such that, for example, we try to lock our to acquire our locks only in an increasing sequence. So we have to we would have to rewrite the sequence in which we acquire our locks. If we are able to do so, because we did that just locally, then we're fine. Also, we could try to change our program in a way that at the point where we want to acquire a lock which would violate our established ordering between all the locks, then we could change the program such that we would release the violating lock and reacquire all the locks that we need in different order. However, that also might not be a valid modification there. And yeah, in that case, we are probably stuck and have to rethink our whole algorithm. An example for an algorithm which we cannot really do in a deadlock-free way is the one that we've seen in our foo class. That's just, well, there is no way to come up with a proper with a proper way. We have a deadlock there because we have different we've used different means of acquiring our locks, and we cannot really exchange them for one or another, and we have to rethink of what we're actually doing there. So yeah, but that's just an arbitrary it's an example which is quite non-practical, let's say. So for example, in a practical system, we have had the double linked queue as examples so far, and what we've seen is the pop write function in some way, and there was we have tried to make it to make it keep a consistent state by using semaphore already, but if we want to support a little bit of more of parallelism, we might think of a situation where when we do our pop write, we might want to introduce more parallelism by kind of differentiating situations where we have to look at just one end of the queue, or where we have to also keep the other end of the queue locked. When do we need that? Well, imagine that we have a situation where we have only only one particular single element in our list, and we, if we want to remove that, then we have to keep both the left and the right sentinel in our hands. And if we have more than one element in our list, we don't need to touch the, I think, which one is it? The left sentinel doesn't have to be touched. We are just modifying the right sentinel, and we can still grant access to the other end of the list if someone wants to add something there. So in order to grant access to the left end of our doubly linked list, we can introduce a kind of more refined version of locking access to our doubly ended list by introducing not only a lock at the very beginning where we start to query for sentinels, but also in the situation where we have the left sentinel as our as our other partner in there. And yeah, in these cases we would have to lock have to acquire also another lock, which is the one that we would use specifically for modifying the is it the left sentinel or the right sentinel here? I think it's even just about setting the right sentinel. Well, it's a little bit difficult without the graphics here to exactly state which of the sentinels we have to we have to protect with which of the locks here. But I think yeah, we can probably deal with that in the tutorial. You already have the code for the version with just one lock in the solutions of the of last tutorial's exercise. So we can have a more detailed look in the tutorial. So I will probably skip over that right now because that's a little bit tedious without the graphics here. Anyway, in the end, we would have a structure of our program where we have, well, we abstract now away from the difficult internals and just keep the acquiring and releasing of our locks still in there. So we would have a wait and a signal on one of the of the locks, and this one is also this also release here because we end our program. There's a second lock now acquired within here, which is this one, and yeah, this can now, for example, be one of the yeah, this can be an example for checking whether our complete algorithm is now deadlock free or not, and well. In push left, we will, yeah. Now we have to compare this implementation of the, pop right with the push left implementation, and check what push left is now creating as or contributing to the lock order. And turns out that in push left we only had one of the locks used, so push left doesn't create a new contribution to our log order. And here we have one contribution of the log order where we would come up with the order that the the log T is dominated by the log S. And yeah, since the other one only uses one lock, the program is kind of trivially deadlock free. But if we have more than just these two methods to access our queue, we would continue in that fashion. We would try to determine for each of these procedures the how the lock sets are evolving throughout the procedure, and at each point where we acquire one of the locks, we would generate new contributions to the lock order like this, and we would keep them in a global in a global ordering, where we would, or in a global invariant, which is just the ordering between these locks, and we would afterwards evaluate whether we have created a circle in there or not. So that is the typical way to ensure that the whole thing is deadlock-free. So to come to an end with locks, let's round it up a little bit. I want to highlight one specific aspect of the whole thing, which is in this case the relation of locks and atomic executions. You remember the atomic annotation? That was some kind of way for us to describe on a quite high level that we want a certain fraction of our code to be atomic, and to be a kind of transaction. So if we try to replace our locks with atomic annotations, so we could, for example, do away with that and introduce an atomic, which would span this thing here. We also could get rid of this one because, well, after we've returned, we also exit this block. So that's the same semantics. And yeah, that would be one way to make the whole thing atomic. However, this part here, if we would try to solve it in this way, this is not so easy, because in this case we only would have acquired the lock in case that a certain condition was fulfilled. That is something that we cannot directly translate with an atomic block, because if we keep this guard here in front of the atomic block, well, in case that the condition was false, the original program would have still executed the code over here, but just wouldn't have protected this area. However, if we do just use this atomic block here, we would only have executed the whole part between the atomic block braces here if the condition would have evaluated to true, and if not, it wouldn't have executed that part at all. So replacing a pair of wait and signal with an atomic block won't just do the trick. It's much more complicated than that. So the locks convey some kind of additional information about the atomic. Also, what atomic is missing is this the special relation to a certain lock, and different locks are kind of not depending on each other. So they things that are protected with different locks can kind of be executed concurrently, while when we do such an atomic block, we would have to analyze in some way the variables that are used inside for the information whether we actually can interleave them in some way or not. And yeah, that's really not so easy. So yeah, also the other direction, if we have atomic declarations, it's not so easy to determine how to obtain the correct locks for that. So yeah, atomic execution and locks are nothing that we can just replace each other with easily. However, atomic is a kind of high-level construct that is actually quite is quite convenient and would be nice to have for programming. We could try to implement atomics with just one single lock for all the atomic blocks out there, but with that we would keep a lot of concurrency that would actually be allowed to happen from being realized. For example, in the push left and pop right example, there's if we would introduce this atomic in all the situations there, then yeah, there's a lot of concurrency which is lost with that. Also, there's a lot of these. If you do this in a global scope, there's a lot of statements that modify variables which don't have anything to do with any other part. And for that, we wouldn't just need a lock between shared between those two regions. Yeah. With that, we see that this the simple realization of such atomic sections with locks just isn't satisfying for our needs. Well, we'll see in the next presentation what is there to help us with our atomic high-level constructs. However, let's just wrap up a little bit on the means that we have seen so far. In practical systems, we have the ability to use atomic operations in order to implement these weight-free algorithms. In Java and C#, we have more high-level constructs. There, it's quite natural to program with monitors and condition variables, which often simplify programming, but nevertheless still create problems of deadlocks. So what we can do in different practical systems is somehow summarized in this table here. For that, we differ between the low-level and the high-level languages. There's this C/C# fraction of languages where we have, in a quite natural way, barriers and weight-lock-free instructions. Also, semaphores and mutexes can be quite easily implemented. That's all that, I think, is what we have seen in the last tutorial. So. Yeah. Also, the monitor can be obtained. However, that relies on having a re-entrant attribute available in the threading implementation. But nevertheless, in C++, you have the whole choice of means for synchronizing your programs. Then there's the fraction of the more higher level languages with the examples of Java and C#, which are both more on a level of a virtual machine. And there, the kind of natural way of implementing synchronization of threads is on the more higher level constructs with mutexes and monitors. And also there's support for semaphores, either by constructing them out of already the existing means, like synchronized methods, or some API classes and calls to certain methods. And also, in the newer releases of APIs of Java and C#, you will find means for weight and lock-free programming with a Java util concurrent atomic things. You can imagine that's the Java source. And for the C# people, we have the system threading interlocked class. And of course, there's a lot of consorts out there which complete the means for weight lock free algorithms. So, yeah, that also enables Java and C# programmers to come up with lock free implementations of their algorithms. They kind of directly map to the underlying compare and swap and all these lock-free instructions. However, I have not seen support for barriers in the sense that we have used them in C and C sharp. Of course, there's also some other construct of barriers, which is kind of for, in a way that it's for synchronizing, but it's not in a way of memory fences for loading and stores, but more for coordinating kind of continue points for several threads. So it's a little bit of different meaning, the barriers that we have in Java and C sharp. So anyway, that's how we can try out the things that we have seen in this section of the lecture. So in summary, what are these things? We have seen concurrency algorithms for wait-free, lock-free, and locked instructions or constructs. What we have not seen so far is transactional instructions. And these are the ones that we will do in our next set of slides. We have had a focus on wait-free algorithms, for which we have seen the properties that they never block, and they can they always succeed. They do not deadlock. There's no starvation, but they are quite limited. So there's not a whole sequence of instructions that you can do, that, but just one or two instructions. Then we've seen lock-free algorithms, which never block. They may fail in some way, but they never deadlock. But, oh, no, that's not. Also, that's more greenish. No. They never block, and they may starve in some way. However, the invariants that can be covered with that are quite small. They can only span a few bytes, for example, 8 on the Intel. Then there's locking algorithms, with which we can just guard arbitrary code. We can use several locks to enable more fine-grained concurrency. Okay, they may deadlock. That's the important part there. And we've seen how we can determine whether we have deadlock-free things. Yeah, and also we have had the differences between re-entrant semaphores, which are the monitors, or the just the plain semaphores. And yeah, with that we should be able to choose the approach that best fits our need. Also, I think we had in the tutorial quite nice an overview on how to access the different approaches and what they imply in respect of runtime penalty. Okay, think that's just the references for you to have a look at if you're more interested. So let's probably switch over to the next part. Is there still questions on the part with locks, lock-free and wait-free? No? So let's have a look at the next one. So we are now looking at transactions as the last of our concurrency topics. So transactions are something that are more on the offer more abstract view on the on concurrency than the means that we have seen so far. In how can we interpret something like this abstraction? Well, abstraction is always one thing where we want to not think about the internals all the time of how something works, and the transactions are also things that should support us in composition of our software, and these two things are closely related. In what sense? For example, think back to the example with the doubly linked list that we had. We had mentioned something like this for all and the push left, and that is something that we had for our linked list. And if we want to use this linked list data structure in a kind of abstract way to compose something like a class to realize set objects, we might internally resort to using the linked list, which we have made secure to use concurrently, and for implementing such a set out of our linked list, we could, for example, directly map the provided functions like the push left to one of the methods from such a set, which would expose some kind of certain of these operations. However, if we then continue on with implementing something new for our set, we would, for example, want to have something like an insert operation, and for an insert in a set, before we can insert with the internal push left, we would have to, for example, use the for all operation to check whether the thing already exists or not, and then afterwards only we would then use the push left to insert our new thing. So if we do so, we would kind of compose our new functionality from the abstract methods from our old implementation. However, a property like the linked list, which lies below the set, whether the linked list is thread safe, is not automatically propagated to our composed set class, which is using this for all and push left independently of each other. And even if we try to overcome the fact that between the for all and the push left there is no kind of connection, and we might be able to be interrupted there if we add a new mutex here to make our set thread safe, we still have the situation that when we would have secured our insert in a thread safe way, then there's still the old exposed methods where we use another mutex to achieve thread safe behavior of the internal linked list, and that is something for that we would need to either use exactly the same mutex that we had in that we had used within the double linked list to make sure that the thread safeness is provided across all the methods, or we would have to add the same mutex that we have added to the insert method around all the calls to the internally used the internally used double linked list. And yeah, anyway, how you do it, you will never come to in a situation where abstraction and composition are happening in a way that it's, that they're really easy to achieve, and you always have to look into the internals of one or the other, or you lose the fact that you could easily compose things from each other. So with the means of mutexes and locks and all the things that we have seen so far, we don't get a convenient way of abstraction and composition. Instead, the idea would be to go over to use something like these atomic blocks instead of trying to secure our methods with locks ourselves. And yeah, with these atomic blocks, we could try to ensure that all our statements are used in an atomic way. And with that, we would, for example, get the desired property that if we have atomic block in there, we can just extend it by adding another atomic without even having to care which specific lock has been used inside. We just don't care. We specify it as atomic, and that just works. And also, we don't have to exactly rely on that we use the same lock as some other portion of the code, which fiddles with the same data, but just use atomic on both sides. And if we access the same data fields, then this atomic is semantically meaning that these things cannot occur at the same time. So, yeah, atomic is something quite desirable. The idea would be that if we use such an atomic block, we would mean that we would want to execute the code in an atomic way. The nested code, that's the nested blocks, would act like a single atomic block. That's one thing that I've already mentioned. However, if another thread interferes while I'm trying to do my atomic computation here, I would have to undo the computation that I've done so far, kind of reset my sequence of instructions, and restart the transaction. Yeah, if I want to have more control on that, I would, for example, come up with a keyword like the retry here, which would be another extension to the underlying language, like we had with the wait for monitors. Yeah. In the context of transactions, we have also the concept of conflict. A conflict is something that occurs when we access the same piece of data. There's a notion of these conflicts. We can detect them, and such a conflict is detected when the Turing machine when a transactional memory system realizes that an access to the same piece of data is happening. And there's also a notion of resolving such a conflict. And it is resolved when Turing machine system takes some kind of action, whatever that might be, delaying or aborting a transaction. It's not defined that much in detail, but these are the important things that that define how our transactional memory system works. So there's a concept of conflicts, and the conflict can occur, it can be detected, and can be in some way resolved. And how our transactional memory system is implemented is also something that's not fixed with just that concept. There's different ways how to approach the topic of transactional memory. You can have concurrency control in different ways. You can do so in an optimistic or pessimistic way. The pessimistic approach to concurrency control would be that the transactional memory system would try to detect whether such a conflict occurs immediately, always before an instruction is executed, and if the next instruction would lead to a conflict, then it would start to act and to resolve. So, what could such a system do in that case? Well, it could probably try to delay the transaction a little bit, which would then, in the end, again lead to something like a deadlock. Well, that's one of the problems that you get with the pessimistic concurrency control system. The other thing that you could imagine is an optimistic system. And what would that be? That would be a system that would happily try to perform a transaction, and at some point after a conflict has already occurred at some place, whether it has been directly immediately before now or somewhere later, the optimistic approach to concurrency control would only then try to detect that there actually has been a conflict, and only then would start to try to resolve the misery. And, well, what can it do to resolve? Well, at that point where the conflict has already occurred, well, there's only one thing to do. You can just abort the transaction and restart it. And, well, yeah, you can do so, of course, quite a lot of times. And in contrast to the pessimistic approach, where we had the problem of deadlocks, so we would just not be able to do anything anymore, we then run into problems of life locking. Has anyone heard of life locking before? I think it's probably quite a natural extension of deadlock. Well, especially if you look at it from a point of view of transactional memory, that would just mean that the transaction is restarted over and over and over again, and although the computation is not really stalled at one particular instruction, you will nevertheless never finish your transaction because it is restarted all the time. So that would be the life lock. Your program still runs, but won't be able to achieve your ultimate goal. Yeah, so we just have enough time to have a look at the next property of concurrency control. Well, there's the eager versus lazy version management, and that determines how read and written data are managed during the transaction. And yeah, you can implement such a transactional memory system in an eager way, which would mean that what you do is you would immediately, when something is writing to memory, you would let it pass through and directly write to the memory, and in meantime you would implement an undo log, where when something goes wrong or amiss and you have to abort, then you would have to perform the undo log to revert the memory to the state that it had been when you started the transaction. And opposed to that is the lazy implementation of the version management of your transactional system. In this case, writes are deferred. They're not directly performed on the memory. Instead, what you do is you keep a redo log, where you insert your your written instructions into a buffer, where until all your modifications are done and you hit commit, and only then everything would be written to main memory. So now that we have a short introduction into transactional memories and the properties with that, I think we should end here, and we continue next time Yeah, thank you for your attention, and goodbye. Have a nice, well, day until tomorrow for everyone who shows up in the tutorial. For everyone else, have a nice week. See you later. Goodbye.